Okay, I propose that we resume our meeting to talk about a paper on revenue recognition, specifically about disclosures in interim reporting periods. Who can I invite to introduce this topic?
Glenn?
Glenn, can you hear me? Glenn? I think he can hear us, no?
Can you hear us?
He can hear us.
Just wave your hand. Wave your hand.
Yeah, but I don't think he hears.
Scratch your head.
Glenn, go ahead and present your paper.
And rub your stomach.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay. Go ahead, Glenn.
Good. So this is paper 7, paper 154, and what we would like to do is to seek your views on whether an entity should apply the proposed revenue disclosure requirements to interim financial statements or only to annual financial statements. Now, this was an issue that was brought to our attention as we were drafting the revised exposure draft. Now, that draft and also the 2010 ED didn't specify interim disclosure requirements. So in the absence of specific guidance, an entity would apply the...
That's better than my fault.
Okay, good. So you've been able to hear me so far?
Yeah, it works though.
Yep.
Yeah. It seems to be worse now. Go ahead.
Oh dear. So in the absence of any specific guidance, which was the case under the 2010 ED and under the early drafts of the revised ED, an entity would have to apply the interim financial reporting requirements in topic 270 in US GAAP and IAS 34 to determine the information that an entity should disclose in interim periods. However, given the comments we received through the drafting process, we've taken a fresh look at the interim disclosure requirements. And so in this paper, there are two issues for the boards to consider. The first issue is whether the ED should specify disclosures that an entity should make in interim financial statements, of course, subject to that information being material, or whether the entity should use their judgment and apply the disclosure principles in topic 270 and IAS 34 to determine which disclosures should be included in those interim financial statements. And that's discussed around paragraphs 10 to 17 of the paper. And then if the boards decide to specify some revenue disclosures for interim financial statements, the next step is to identify those disclosures that should be required. And that probably takes us to the staff recommendation, which follows paragraph 27. And there the staff recommendation is that we should amend topic 270 in US GAAP and IAS 34 to specify that an entity makes the disclosures required by paragraphs 114, 117, 119, 122, 123, and 128. Now, broadly, they're disclosures of information that we would expect would change from period to period, and typically they're quantitative disclosures. We would recommend that we clarify in the basis that the other disclosure requirements should not be required, or not be specifically required for interim periods, but that an entity would apply the disclosure principle in topic 270 and IAS 34 to determine whether there's been a significant change in that information and therefore would warrant disclosure. And those other disclosures are typically information that wouldn't change from period to period and is largely qualitative type information. The very end of the paper also considers for the FASB whether non-public entities should be required to make any interim disclosures. Bill Hans, I'll hand it back to you for board discussion.
Um,
I support the staff's recommendation in part, but not in full. I need to disclose up front that I wrote IAS 34 for IASC, and so I have some vested interest in it. It's a principle-based standard on interim reporting. And with regard to disclosure, and it's kind of a roll-forward standard, which says, first, you include in your interim report an explanation of any events or transactions that are significant to understand the changes in financial position and performance since the last annual reporting period. And it goes on and says you can presume the user of an interim report will have access to the most recent annual financial report of the entity. Now, in IAS 34, I counted them. There's two paragraphs and 28 required disclosures, mandatory, for all of interim reporting. There's certain events and changes that are listed and says you've got to disclose these. And then there's 9 other requirements. It's in paragraphs 15B and 16A. Now, IAS 34 was issued 13 years ago. And while the IASB has added one or two little disclosures, we have issued dozens of new standards and updated standards, and we have never updated IAS 34 for the magnitude of additional disclosures that's being proposed here. I can see a similar issue will be coming on leases, and one by one for every other project that we're working on. And at some point, if we do that, then we need to go back what's been done in the last 13 years and what additional disclosures should we add into 34. I know I'm not on the side of the angels here because I can understand that the financial statement users will say, well, more is better than less. So I have a compromise proposal that I think is consistent with the principles-based approach in IAS 34 and will give the users what they need when they need it. So here's my compromise. In paragraph 16A of IAS 34 today is a list of those 13 or whatever it is mandatory disclosures. Add to that list the proposed disaggregation of revenue. I think that's a good mandatory disclosure in every interim report. And then paragraph 15B of IAS 34 lists the kinds of changes since the last annual financial statements that would require disclosure if significant. So I would add to that paragraph a requirement to disclose significant changes in revenue-related assets and liabilities, such as contract assets and liabilities, performance obligations, cost to fulfill contracts with customers. It would not make those roll-forward reconciliations and the maturity analysis a mandatory disclosure, but instead my proposal would make it consistent with everything else we've done in IAS 34, which is to say if it's significant to an understanding of the changes since the last annual, put it in your interim, but don't mandate that everybody put in what you're proposing. So that's my proposal.
Darryl.
I share the concerns that Paul is stating. I would hate to see us continue sort of incrementally with every project, add a little bit more interim disclosure here and a little bit more here. I'm just concerned about the totality of it adding up to be onerous given the short filing times that companies have to pull all of this information together. So I am sympathetic, particularly in the revenue area, that users have said that current disclosure requirements are inadequate. So I was looking for some middle ground, and I think maybe Paul has given me something there that seems reasonable.
Russ.
Well, I agree with the staff's recommendation. I believe that
revenue recognition and what is reported on an interim basis does move valuations of companies. And I think it's very important to an investor understand the disaggregation of revenue and some of the tabular reconciliations. That said, I don't feel the same way about leases and some of the things that we'll be asked to vote on going forward. I think it is revenue is a special number that drives valuations. I think investors need to understand what has changed in the interim period.
Stephen?
I just like to say I agree with Paul. I think it's an excellent suggestion. I think it strikes the right balance. I think the staff recommendation isn't the right balance. It's too much in there. I think it's inconsistent with IS 34. But I think we need to do something, and I wholeheartedly support what Paul suggested.
Larry?
I think investors have told us that disclosures for revenue are woefully inadequate. We'll come up with a lot of disclosures. However, I'm very sensitive to the filing timing requirements, especially here in the U.S., and people's ability to meet those requirements. I personally think Paul has come up with a pretty good recommendation that's not inconsistent with our interim reporting requirements. I think the only thing, I don't know if you had owner's contracts in there when you mentioned it.
I forgot. I should have.
Okay. I would add, whether the balance of owner's contracts has changed or the degree to which it's changed and why or something like that. But otherwise, I think describing the significant changes but not requiring the roll forwards will be a considerably easier for preparers to compile the information, but not leave investors without some information about changes. So I think it's a good suggestion.
Young?
I think the proposal is over-engineering, and it's an unnecessary over-engineering. I think that the whole topic about interim reporting could possibly be reviewed. I think it's a very bad precedent if we take this standard and say that we should inject some of these disclosures we have here, like proposed or otherwise. I personally really question Larry and a few others that we are helping the analysts very much or the investors very much by doing this. I have attended a lot of different presentations of different companies and read a lot of quarterly reports, etc. And very few companies don't focus the top line. They give information about volumes and market development and market shares, product spreads. So yesterday, for example, Apple presenting how many iPads and how many iPhones, etc., divided into volumes and into revenues so people can make their conclusions. One of the most important conclusions of the report is to get a quick idea about how is margin development and how is volume development. And if we really are to address this, I think we have quite another project ahead of us. I think we have a very bad precedent, as I said, if we started each project to add on disclosures on the quarterly reporting. We heard just a couple of weeks ago a tentative idea to reduce the demand of reporting from 3 months to 6 months in certain markets, which I don't think is a very good thing. But it is an expression of that some people think that it's important not to have an overburden in this reporting. So I think we should really, if we should go into this, have a thorough analysis and not just sweeping arguments that we need to help the analysts.
Larry, you feel a need to respond to me?
I guess what I don't understand about your comments is I think personally. Paul has really zeroed in on combined with staff, some of the real important disclosures relative to revenue. And it doesn't appear as if it's inconsistent with your statement that companies do a lot of analysis and disclose a lot of things, albeit offline, through their analysts' meetings and calls, et cetera. So if they already have that information, why not have it disclosed?
Well, I think that you, at least in my mind, would immediately enter into follow-up questions on segment reporting and et cetera. You go in to do a proper business analysis that you will support. And now we would prescribe that just on the top line, on revenue line, we would ask for this, while we leave it open in a number of other places. So I think you're immediately asking for the follow-up information, which is not bad, but I think we shouldn't sit here and sort of make a little bit ad hoc solution to this.
Hal?
I just wanted to follow up on what I thought I heard from Larry and Paul, is that the roll-forward schedules would be at the judgment discretion.
Use the mic, Hal.
Sorry. The roll-forward schedules will be at the conclusion or opinion of the preparer? Is that
my proposal is, yes, it would be, as we require for all other interim disclosures, is it significant for understanding the changes since the last annual reporting, annual statements?
I would just take the opposite view that it may save a few dollars for the preparer to do it, but you're transferring a significant amount of cost to the users, and there are far more users than there are preparers. So I would advocate, since most models are built on quarterly types of information, not annual, if you only do something annually and you don't do it quarterly, it dramatically decreases the value to the investors, particularly those who model out companies. So I think if you're going to provide it to get maximum benefit, you provide it quarterly, and to minimize the cost collectively between preparer and investor, you would mandate that it is done on a quarterly basis.
Doc?
Yes, I can't understand why we should challenge to the quarterly basis when we still think it's a contentious whether this disclosure should be included in the annual disclosure. Because now it's revenue recognition standard is going to be exposed again. And we are now discussing whether this issue itself would be approved. Then why do we have to challenge the interim as well? Because if something is wrong, or it may be too costly, then we have to reconsider it, like a post-implementation review. So then why do we have to do it interim basis at the same time? So we should look and see how the annual disclosure goes and see how the cost, the benefit exceeds the cost.
But then it wouldn't
be too late.
But then we'd have to re-expose again. Sure. The point is to put the proposed disclosure, what you think is important to investors, but yet doable by preparers and auditors, and expose that now so that we can come up to the final decision when we re-deliberate after the exposure draft.
That could be an amendment to AS44 separately from this project. The project is about annual. It's a revenue recognition model. Whether we take any conclusions from that onto the interims is a separate discussion, I think. So we don't have to deal with interims in this project.
There you go.
Sure. Yeah. I fully agree with what Paul proposed for two reasons. First, the items proposed by Paul is in line with the objectives and the principles of the 34. It is quite important. And secondly, as Paul said, if when we develop a particular new standards like revenue, we want to add something to 34, then how about the others? And should we do the same? And I don't think I remember in the past we did so, and so hence I fully agree with Paul not include those reconciliations and roll forward.
Before we bring this to a vote, Glenn, would you like to react?
I've got nothing to add, hence.
Excuse me?
Sorry, did you ask if I had anything to add?
Yes.
Do you want
to react on what has been said? But I see that I didn't give the word to board members, so let's do that first.
Okay.
I just wanted to say that I also agree with Paul. I thought that the staff's proposal was good, but I didn't think that everything that was listed here would always be necessary for a company to provide on an interim basis. The ED was silent on whether the disclosures we were proposing were required or not on an interim basis, so that would require a preparer to go to 34 and follow those principles. And I've heard some suggest that in some jurisdictions that would be interpreted as them having to apply all of the disclosure requirements on an interim basis. The regulators in those jurisdictions would interpret it that way. So I think by following Paul's suggestion, we get the disclosures that are absolutely essential on an interim basis for financial statement users, and at the same time give preparers some certainty about what their minimum reporting requirements are on an interim basis.
Tom?
I'm in a minority here, but I agree with what Russ has said. I think our whole interim reporting model that we've developed is one in which we have stated quarters are an integral part of the whole. In reality, I don't think that's any longer the case. I think markets move and look at quarters as discrete events and want the information discreetly about each of those quarters. So while I understand why Paul is concerned that we're going to build up IAS 34, whatever our parallel literature is, by taking this action, I don't think this has to be precedential at all. But I do believe that revenue is extremely important. And suggesting if we were to put in what the staff proposes with a materiality box and or not, if we just said significant there, I think we'd be getting high quality information in the discrete quarterly events about probably the most important driver of market reactions at that time. So I will support the staff recommendation.
That's
I concur with what Tom and Russ have said. And the question I have for the board and the staff is essentially this. In order to provide this information on an annual basis, my experience, and granted it's dated in terms of an audit experience, but from an analytical experience and looking at information that companies provided to me as an analyst, told me that they needed to have systems of internal accounting controls operating throughout the year to do this on an annual basis, which means they went through this exercise quarterly. So the incremental work involved is essentially presenting that in a set of financial statements, not actually preparing a roll forward or a disaggregation analysis or what have you. That has to be done anyway if you have a system of internal accounting controls that are going to provide this information on an annual basis. You just don't decide in November, oh, we need to do that roll forward, let's get working on that. You know, we haven't touched it since last October or last November. It doesn't work that way. So on its face, okay, this information is prepared in a normal operating, course of business. And I don't see the reason why that creates an incremental burden. If you're going to have to do it on an annual basis, you have to do it throughout the year.
Can I respond to that? It's probably true at the entity level, the company level, in the group. Each company will have to do it at its level. Otherwise, it cannot keep the books in accordance with the standard. The problem is more the consolidation of this information, multi-currency, multi-company environment, and to prepare the road forward on a consolidated basis, explaining all the movements, including changes in the consolidation perimeter, companies acquired, disposed of, changes in translation differences. That is extremely complex in consolidation. So I agree that entity level is okay, but moving up to the group level, given the delays.
But you can't do it once a year and get it right.
You can do it once a year and get it right, but probably the reporting time is different at your end, that is in quarterly basis.
How would that be, Kay?
Flea, but you almost made the argument for doing it on a quarterly basis, because if it's that complex and there are that many moving parts, it would be tremendously valuable to investors.
Wow. Not sure if that's it. EK.
Slightly different question. I don't recollect whether the staff meant that some of this disclosure should be condensed as required or as applicable to the condensed financial statements, because IAS 34 gives you an option to either present full set of financial statements or condensed. But when you come to SX 10, the interim financial reporting standards in the US, it's condensed. So what is the disaggregation of revenue you have in mind in terms of, do you want it as presented under annual report or under condensed, because some of the information can be different because how the numbers move from period to period?
Glenn.
I think there, PK, we would have in mind that an entity prepares a disaggregation. If it were to be required to present the disaggregation, that it would present it on the same basis that it presents the disaggregation in its annual financial statements, regardless of whether its interim financial statements are condensed or a full set. And that's consistent with paragraph 15 of IAS 34, where it says an entity should update the types of information which it discloses in its annual financial statements.
Question for the Paul approach. Would you expect management to do this to prove to an auditor that it's not significant and therefore not disclosed?
Well, I would expect the same issue to arise for every disclosure that we require, because our interim reporting standard says present updates since your last annual. I'm not proposing anything more onerous for revenue than for any other aspect.
And I apologize because I don't know all the things that's in IAS 34, but are those factors there, are they related to the top line, the most significant operation number? Are they related to impairments? In other words, are they related to events that continue, or they relate to one-time events?
More one-time events.
Right. So one-time events I could see. I don't have the impairment. I don't need to deal with it. But if I have a continuous revenue stream, so every period I'm going to have to evaluate my receivable change. Every period I'm going to evaluate my contract asset change. I'm afraid, under your approach, management's going to have to do it anyway. Exactly. The auditor's going to have to evaluate it. So all we're talking about incremental is, do we just want to tell the user? But I don't know IAS 34 about you.
Let me just read you a sentence from it. Therefore, it is unnecessary in the notes to the interim financial report to provide relatively insignificant updates to the information that was reported in the notes in the most recent annual financial statements. That's from 34. That's the principle that we have.
But I think one of Glenn's points is that when you're talking about revenue transactions, everything has changed in the period.
Exactly. Everything material.
And I guess, Paul, I wasn't quite clear from your proposal whether you would expect people to describe some information, or whether if they think that they're caught by the requirement that they would provide the reconciliation to satisfy the disclosure requirement. So what would you expect people to provide if they decide a sort of change in contract assets and liabilities?
They would do the right thing, because we have a principle-based standard. So I don't think we should list in the standard all that you're proposing to list and say, this is mandatory. I would say we have a principle, and our constituents ought to be following our principle.
Can I respond to that? I would think that in the reconciliation of the contract balance, to the extent that your contract asset or liability hasn't changed that much. You have not had a considerable change in in the volume of your business, et cetera, and you have not had any business combinations, I would expect that the contract balance probably hasn't changed dramatically, and therefore no extra disclosure would be necessary. To the extent that you've had a large business combination, or you've had, you know, huge fourth quarter sales or something like that, you would expect a fairly significant change in your contract balance and therefore a corresponding explanation as to what gave rise to that change. That's what I thought Paul was saying, and that's what I support.
They go, and then I think we should come to that.
If you trace back the history in the past 10 years, you can find some countries, some jurisdictions introduce interim reports, but other jurisdictions withdraw interim report for some reasons. And secondly, in terms of a content, sometimes some jurisdiction add something, other times, you know, simplify something. So we are not debate on whether those information is useful or not. We are discussing about how to make a trade-off, make a balance. This is important. And so this is why I support, you know, following the Paul's suggestion. And last you mentioned about the auditors-related issues. But as I understand, in many jurisdictions, interim reports are not required to be audited.
In the U.S., they're required to be reviewed by an independent public accountant.
Yeah, but it's not worldwide general requirement.
Okay, I think it's probably wise that we first take a vote on Paul's less far-reaching proposal and then take it from there. So, ISB, who supports...
Could you please repeat then what we are voting on?
Paul, could you phrase it as precisely as possible? But you...
I propose that paragraph 16A, which is the list of mandatory interim disclosures, add to that list the proposed disclosure of disaggregation of revenue. So that's in the statute. I propose that in paragraph 15B of 34, which is a list of the kinds of changes since the last annual financial statements that would require disclosure in the interim report if significant, add to that list the requirement to disclose significant changes in revenue-related assets and liabilities, such as Larry was talking about, or contract assets and liabilities, performance obligations, cost to obtain or fulfill contracts with customers, and add in onerous contracts. Larry mentioned that I omitted here.
So who's in favor of that?
Isn't the easiest way to do that is to deliver the information the staff recommended in order to deliver on your recommendation?
No. It's got a lot more than the staff recommendation. Well, and that's what he's taking out.
Well, the only thing... If I may, the staff, I think it might be helpful, and Paul described how the amendments would work in IFRS's, but of course it would work a little bit differently, similarly in U.S. GAAP. But I think looking at the staff recommendation, I suppose you could look in paragraph 3, there are 5 specific disclosures that the staff recommended at a minimum be provided on an interim basis. And I think there's a bit of a question with regard to PK's question. I think item 1, Paul is saying that the disaggregation of revenue would be required to be mandatory on the same basis as for the annual period. But for items 2 through 5, I think these are the items that you would disclose if significant on an interim basis. But my question, I think it's Henderson, PK was getting to as well, would it be on the, if significant, would it be on the same basis or presented the same way as for the annual period, or is it a simplified, condensed description?
Said another way, if the receivable is significant, do I just show the receivable or do I do the roll forward? I hear you saying just the receivable, not the roll forward. Then that concerns me because I think you need to see the components of what's changed. I heard you say just the receivable.
Or do you do the roll forward, or do you just describe that your contract assets have gone up because of the business compensation?
That's what I would
do. What is what you would do?
I'm sorry to repeat. I would stick with the principle in 34, which means the company must assess whether the entire roll forward provides necessary information to understand the change since the last.
So it could decide to include the role of vote.
It could.
It could, but not necessarily.
But it doesn't. Neither does it exclude it.
And it does not exclude it.
So now that we know precisely what Paul is proposing, who would like to support that? ISB. FESB.
I was worried about that.
Could I ask something? Would FASB be willing to support it if it was concluded significant, you did the full thing? So you still make the test on significance. If not significant, if you're off the hook. But if significant, you do the full thing.
And how do you measure it? No,
John. Since this suggestion...
I'm just asking FASB.
How would you define significant?
Yes,
I see a situation where the balance, balance sheet does not change. But the massive changes within those numbers that can be very influential in decision.
The way I look at this, we use words like significant, and you make a judgment on that. That's kind of the principal notion. But once you say it is, what do you do? And the only thing that caused me to pause on what Paul was saying was I could conclude significant, and I can give some kind of description without giving you a real understanding of the numbers. So that caused me to pause on it. And so I know FASB didn't vote for it. I thought if you were required to do something, once you concluded, would that get you over the hump?
Leslie.
The reason I didn't support Paul's approach was that we had a recent experience here in the U.S. with respect to our OCI standard, where we worked under the presumption that it was going to be a pretty minor change for companies to implement, and we recently gotten feedback, which we'll plan to talk about later, that to provide that information on a detailed basis, on a quarterly basis, is a very different effort than they had anticipated. And so my basis for exposing it to say it's required for interim is I think we're going to get significant feedback if we make it clear that it would be required, or at least you'd have to evaluate it on an interim basis, than we would if we didn't require it in this ED. And I'll be honest with you, Hans and I were at a conference earlier this week where multinational preparers were asserting that the cost to implement these disclosures in the revenue recognition standard were more significant than their estimates to adopt IFRS in total. So I think we're going to have to take a really careful look at the cost-benefit having to do with these disclosures generally, not just these interim ones. And so I would rather get the most robust feedback we can get on the cost-benefit relating to disclosures through this exposure draft than have any concerns going to final that we have not adequately assessed the cost.
So your vote was not necessarily because you support full disclosure, but
I want to get the feedback
more information.
So you bring up the cost a little bit so that we get proper feedback.
Yes.
that's the theory.
I think we get different feedback when we say use your judgment than we get when we say this might be required.
Well, I would be willing to follow that if you then, in second instance, are going to take a very serious look at that.
Right, that's my goal.
Because it seems to me that standard after standard, we are adding up and adding up, and in the meantime, all sorts of groups are trying to. You are in a study with IFREC, I think, on disclosures, and everybody's trying to respect the costs of disclosures. So when are we going to start doing so? I don't see us starting doing so. And here we have a principle-based IAS 34, which until now has worked reasonably well. like Paul is proposed to stick to it. This is a sort of an override, adjusting the IS 34. When are we? I'm willing to go along with Leslie here and expose this and see whether indeed it's true that this will add to the cost tremendously, whether we'll get a lot of pushback. But the question is, of course, when are we going to take this pushback seriously? Because until then, I haven't seen one signal yet that we ever take the costs of disclosures as a serious problem. Patricia.
My concern with following Leslie's logic is that my belief was, my perception of the response to the ED, which was silent on the interim reporting, that a lot of the concern about the cost of the disclosures that were being proposed was because people were reading it as being disclosed at each reporting period, and that meant every interim report. And so one of the reasons why I supported Paul's proposal is because it would clarify that these weren't necessarily required at every reporting period, but they were required annually, and you provided them quarterly if they were significant. And I think that that would have an effect, perhaps, on the cost of providing them.
But that's not Paul's recommendation.
But, well, how do we go forward? Because we have two opposite views here. Could we take it forward by starting with the proposal as proposed by the staff, and then ask a specific question? That another possibility could be the proposal that has just been put forward by Paul. Would that result in significant reduction of costs without significant increase in transparency? That might be a way to bring this forward, and then we might get more precise answers to this problem.
Philippe, it seems to me that we're trying here to pursue two different objectives. One is to agree on a revenue recognition model with open disclosures. The other one is to try to converge our guidance on internal reporting, which is today somewhat different. It's been said by Tom that in the US you look at the quarters as being discrete periods. It's not that true under IS 34. And then, is this a proper time and place to try to converge our guidance on internal reporting? And if we put too much emphasis on this question of disclosures, we make it clear that we try to fix here and now a matter of just internal disclosures, internal reports. I don't think we are doing a good service to this project by trying to fix at the same time some differences in internal reporting guidance. And we bear the risk. We run the risk of having a rejection of the disclosures that we propose on an annual basis just because of the burden that is imposed on the quarters. So the risk is that people will reject.
Actually, MPB 28 takes the same view.
Glenn, do you want to say something on this issue?
Thanks, Hans. I just wanted to perhaps recap a little. So the first issue for the boards was whether we should specify interim disclosures in this standard or rely on the disclosure principle in 34 and topic 270. Now, I think Patricia and others have expressed it well in that by specifying the disclosures, we're providing clear instruction to the entity as to what disclosures are required. And there seems to be sort of, as I hear from here, there seems to be general consensus that we should specify the disclosures. The question is, what disclosures should we specify and how should we do that? In the paper, I guess we had proposed that you do those quantitative disclosures, very similar to the ones Paul identified, but an entity should disclose them where that information is material. Now, Paul has suggested that, with the exception of the disaggregation, that an entity would make those disclosures where that information is significant or there's a significant change. In paragraph 11 of the paper, I just wanted to draw your attention to that. We sort of do an analysis as to what we think might mean, what might be meant by significant. And we concluded that revenue is likely to be significant in amount. Revenue is a flow and therefore is likely to change significantly from period to period. and explaining the nature of the change would be best communicated by disclosing the same types of information as the annual financial statements. So if you accept that A, B, and C in 11, which you may not, but if you accept that, I think the argument as to whether these disclosures are significant or whether they're material, there probably isn't that much of a difference. I think so. I don't know how far apart the different views at the board table are.
I don't think Glenn characterized my view correctly. It's not whether it's significant versus material, but what IAS 34 says, is the event or transaction significant to an understanding of the changes in financial position and performance of the entity since the end of the last annual reporting period? That's, I'm not making a distinction, just a choice of word between material and significant. I'm saying IAS 34 says, does it give you information about changes in the last 3 months or 6 months? And if it doesn't, then no need to mandate the disclosure.
Darrell.
Yeah, well, I think what Leslie suggested would probably prompt comment from preparers about the cost of complying with that requirement. I would be concerned that it might not prompt comment from users who would agree with the full disclosure on an interim basis. And then if based on preparer comments we back off later, then we may frustrate the ability of users to be able to comment on the proposal that Paul has, which may be where we end up anyway. I would just be
a solution to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I just make this observation, Paul? I would have finished your observation in paragraph 15, which I'm reading as well, with this punchline. It says, information that you deem to be significant, okay, is disclosed in relationship to those events and transactions. You shall update the relevant information presented in the most recent annual financial report. So if you deem it to be significant, you have to go back and update the information from the most recent annual financial report. You have to do essentially what the staff has recommended. So, circuitously, you have actually supported the staff's recommendation. Yeah, it's right here.
I don't see the two coming together here. So, could we agree with my proposal that we put in the exposure draft? Proposal as proposed by the staff, and that we ask a very specific question outlining the alternative by Paul and see whether people like that better. Then we can make the final decision later.
The only problem I have with that, Hans, is I think that Paul's recommendation and the staff's are really identical.
Disagree.
Yeah.
I disagree.
Yeah.
I think Paul has enough experience to know whether that is true.
You shouldn't have a problem with the recommendation.
Says you have to update the annual information.
Can I ask you if you...
Yeah?
Can I ask you who in the ISB would be ready to follow this proposal?
Can I just get something?
No, I think we have to. Trust me, I don't need to ask, I suppose, because...
Now, the only point that we should make, though, to Daryl's point, we need to do some user outreach to make sure that they're satisfied in case we backtrack.
Yeah.
I think we need to do some joint outreach with users and preparers and help them understand the cost-benefit issues.
Yes.
Okay. Question two, which is FASB only. That means I shut up.
I will take the lead. Thank you for stepping up.
Yes.
Okay, so the basic question for the FASB is whether we want to specify interim disclosures for non-public entities. Staff is recommending not.
Yeah, so a couple of thoughts. One is non-public entities, the boards have effectively already decided that non-public entities would not be required to provide these difficult disclosures even on an annual basis. So to some extent, it's not much of an issue. So we're recommending it.
That's a very wise staff recommendation.
Before we end, let me say that I would consider to dissent over this topic. Not over this, over the
previous one.
Over the disclosures.
No, I use this one. Okay, I think having handled this paper, we are at the end of our REVREC deliberations. And I think it's time to ask if anybody plans to dissent. We just heard one. I look around the table. Tom.
I'm working with the staff right now, but I'm very strongly leaning towards dissenting. I think there's three sets of overarching issues that are in my dissent that I've forwarded to you today, earlier today. But if you want me to publicly state what they are, first, I believe that the standard itself, says the core principle, is that you recognize revenue when you transfer goods or services to the customer. I believe one of the criteria that we've added in continuous reckoning revenue continuously does not require that goods or services get transferred to the customer to recognize revenue. All it requires is that the selling entity receive cash, plus some two other things that are within two other sorts of criteria. I see that overriding the core governing principle. I find that to be a significant issue in the standard. Second, I raise at least three examples of where I think that there are strong internal inconsistencies in how that standard addresses issues within the standard and across the standard. And the third area I raise is a series of operability or auditability concerns that exist within the standard, and I give three illustrations of those particular items.
Okay. So we continue again with DC?
Yeah.
Glenn, I hand the floor over to you.
Glenn, thank you for staying so late. We're going to move back to leasing then.